Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode features Diane Ackerman from her talk as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2007. Ackerman is best known for her 14 books of nonfiction that range wildly in topic from title to title, but that share a theme of examining overlooked subjects or celebrate the extraordinary in the everyday, often with a strong dose of science and history. For example, in her book, A Natural History of the Senses, which made her famous, she weaves together scientific facts with lore and history to create an account of how humans experience the world. Or in her book, A Slender Thread, she describes a year working as a counselor on a suicide and crisis hotline, and she does so with humanity and wonder. In this episode, Ackerman talks about her book, The Zookeeper's Wife, which takes place during World War II and is about a zoo. Yes, that's right, a zoo. But like so much of her work, this tale is not what it appears on the surface. This zoo is in Poland and was transformed by the war, and so were the people who ran it, and their story speaks to humanity's highest moments while also reveals the dark and sometimes bizarre or downright absurd work of the Nazis. Here's Ackerman.
I'm thrilled to be with you and to share this amazing story that has kept me enthralled for many years now. Decades ago, I proposed an essay for National Geographic that would carry me into a primeval forest in Poland, where it borders what is now Belarusia. And I wanted to see the animals of the sort that the Ice Age hunters had painted on the cave walls at places like Lascaux. The world of our early ancestors, with its giant bison and its amazing horses and other ribbed originals, fascinated me, in part because in it animals occupied a niche where holy and tasty combined. And I'd also heard that there were these living fossils running around in this extraordinary Polish forest, but that they had something to do with Nazi perversity. I was curious. I didn't know then, when I proposed this story to my editor at National Geographic, that I was sharing some of Adolf Hitler's and Hermann Göring's longing to revive extinct animals. Their obsession sprang from racist motives, but in one of those twists that history is littered with, it allowed good to triumph instead. As it turned out, National Geographic happened to have a photographer sailing to French frigate shoals in the Hawaiian archipelago to witness the last and very endangered monk seals in the world, and so they dispatched me there instead. But I kept my fascination with the forest and with the horses, and over the next dozen years or so, miscellaneous facts and lore and insights, and generally mind morsels, began to accrete around the idea of the Polish horses and the bison, until I woke up one day primed and coming down with a book. It's how it always happens. It's as if a telegram from my subconscious has been slipped under the door of my awareness. You're falling in love with this facet of life, the mind ink reads. Find out why and engage it in words. And so I rejoined my quest where I'd left it, and very quickly a bizarre story started unfolding that's as hearty and heartful as it is unlikely. A little-known story of World War II about two Christian zookeepers who risked their lives to save over 300 doomed people. Jan Szybinski was a zookeeper with a grand vision for Warsaw's three-year-old zoo when he and Antonina were married in 1931. But it was his wife, Antonina, who first drew me to their story. Zoo life was her Eden. She identified so deeply with animals that when her son was born, she named him Rysz, the Polish word for lynx. In the summer of 1939, their zoo was simply magnificent and also doomed. On a crisp fall day, Nazi bombers destroyed Warsaw, sparing nothing, not even the zoo, which happened to lie near the anti-aircraft guns. As bombs whistled down, zoo buildings exploded, moats rained upward, Iron bars squealed as they wrenched apart. Bullets ripped open the aviary nets, and parrots spiraled upward like Aztec gods and plummeted straight down. Two giraffes lay dead on the ground, legs twisted, shockingly horizontal for a change. The clotted air hurt to breathe, and it stank of burning wood, straw, and flesh. Echoing around the zoo, the tumult surely sounded like 10,000 furies scratching up from hell to unhinge the world. But miraculously, some of the animals did survive at the zoo, and dozens more escaped across the bridge into the downtown area of Warsaw and along old cobblestone streets while the Capitol burned. People who were brave enough to look out of their windows on that day reported seeing, well, what looked like a biblical hallucination unfolding. There was hippopotamus and seal waddling along the banks of the Vistula River, camels and antelope trotting down narrow alleyways, llamas galloping safely beside lions and bears. Writing in her diary, Antonina wondered how many people in Poland were going to suffer the same fate that her zoo animals did. Why is it, she asked herself, that animals can sometimes subdue their predatory ways, and yet humans quickly grow more savage than any beast? After their zoo was bombed, the Christian Jabinskis devised an altruistic and an exceedingly dangerous plan to smuggle Jews out of the Warsaw ghetto and sneak them into the zoo's empty cages. Jan guided them in through the lion's cage by way of a tunnel, and after a few days, he moved the refugees into a very small pheasant's house, and then from there, underground through another tunnel, into the cellar of their villa, which stood right in the center of the zoo and was frequently passed by German soldiers who would come to the zoo grounds just to stroll. It was still somewhat of a park-like place. To avoid attracting suspicion, each person who was in hiding was given the code name of the lost animal whose cage he or she was hiding in. Then they could hand their young son, who was only 5, 6, 7 at the time of the war, a bowl of soup and a hunk of bread and say, maybe the lions are hungry, or I think the possums need to be fed. And no one would suspect a child that young of being so vital a part of this underground railroad. Another 2 dozen people hid inside the Jabinskis' villa, in the basement, in the attic, between the walls, and in a closet with a concealed door. After dark, the household secret guests would emerge from their hiding places to socialize, listen to nightly piano concerts, discuss the war, and laugh at the hijinks of the exotic pets. And there were a lot of pets. An orphan herself, Antonina never could turn away orphan animals, even during the height of the war. With the zoo cages and their villa full of illegal people, Antonina, Jan, and Rish raised an assortment of eccentric animals right inside their home, including a carnivorous, predatory rabbit who used to attack people eating sausage for some reason. It had a thing about sausage. And they had also somehow trained the rabbit to kiss and to announce dinner. Even they thought this was unusual for rabbits. There was also a cat whose newborn litters, for various reasons, were removed and replaced with newborn foxes, which did confuse the cat quite a lot because, after all, they barked. There was a playful pig, a muskrat who built a lodge in the kitchen stovepipe, a cockatoo with a nervous disorder that kept pulling out its feathers, hyperactive baby otters. Think about raising baby otters indoors. Hawks, baby lynxes, a mischievous badger, a drunken hamster that preferred liqueur, hyena pups, and many, many others. Their son loved being a miniature zookeeper. It took his mind off the war, and his favorite animal slept right under the covers with him in his bedroom. One day, when Antonina couldn't find the baby badger, she finally thought to look under Risha's bed, just in time to see Badger pushing the little boy's training potty out into the open and using it as it was intended. So, what with the hidden people all having animal names, and the animals all having human names, and the fierce rabbit stealing meat off of people's plates at the table, and a drunken hamster on the dinner table, and baby foxes absolutely everywhere in the house, it's no surprise that the Polish underground referred to the zoo by the code name of the House Under a Crazy Star. While this was going on, Jan was leading an underground cell of saboteurs who specialized in bombing trains, and he also taught biology in a clandestine university. Even during occupation and during the war, they were graduating doctors. Time after time, the house's secret was nearly exposed. Often while Jan was at work downtown, but Antonina always found a way to placate, divert, or outwit the German soldiers. And any time a German entered the house, she ran to the piano and pounded out a galloping refrain by Offenbach to signal everyone to slip back into their hiding places and be quiet. But at any moment, the hidden refugees were only a floorboard away from their enemies. Although other Poles were being evacuated from the zoo district, the Jabinskis were allowed to continue living in the zoo because they tricked the Nazis, who let them use the zoo to raise pigs to feed and fur animals to clothe the German troops. And so this bizarre hideout that was part sanctuary and part menagerie rode out the war, providing asylum for several complete families, as well as many artists, musicians, lawyers, professors, and scientists, over 300 people altogether. All but two of them survived, and those two died of illness. Everyone else survived the war. Although they lived literally in a glass house with many tall windows wrapping all the way around it in the Bauhaus style, and as a result appeared to have absolutely nothing to hide, the Jabinskis smuggled people to freedom for 3 years solid. Their success would not have been possible without the unwitting help of two high-ranking Nazis. One was an insect lover who directed the labor office adjoining the ghetto. This was a building that literally backed onto the ghetto fence and happened to have a back door that wasn't used very often, but it did open up onto the ghetto. Theatrically and with incredible daring, Jan devised a way to smuggle people out one by one right under the nose of this man. A famous collection of pinned insects, beetles of the Baltic, holds the key to this part of the story. And I did manage to find part of this collection in a very remote village in Poland. And of course, I went there to see the beetles. I didn't speak Polish, and I was trying to explain to the woman who was in charge that I wanted to see bombardier beetles, a personal favorite. And so, not knowing what else to do, I called an entomologist friend, Tom Eisner, in Ithaca, New York. It was about 4 in the morning for him. And fortunately, he answered the phone, and I said, "Hi, Tom, I'm in Poland. Could you please tell me the Latin name for bombardier beetles?" He said, "Sure." You know? And so I was able to find them. A lot of people helped me with the research in different ways, not all of them at 4 in the morning. The other key to this story, though, involves big game hunters. You see, in a thrill of romanticism, the Nazis decided that after the war, the high command would need pure Aryan horses to ride, pure Aryan game to hunt, and of course, a sublime wilderness to use as a kind of royal game preserve. Hermann Göring, who was an avid hunter, and who used to march around his castle dressed in a medieval hunting outfit and carrying a boar spear, became the project's patron. And Lutz Heck, who is director of the Berlin Zoo, became its designer and driving force. Goering authorized Heck to ransack occupied countries for all of the animals that looked the most, like the ones that the Ice Age hunters had painted on the cave walls 20,000 years before, and try to breed back to that fierce, high-spirited ideal, try to recreate extinct animals. Goering pictured Hitler and elite hunters riding mythic horses, hunting savage bulls and giant bison and other game in a pristine forest of dramatically tall 500-year-old trees. It was the stuff of Wagnerian operas. Heck pursued this quest passionately, ruthlessly. The animals in question were all native to Poland, as was the primeval forest, and at that time during the war, Jan Szczepinski was the world's authority on the forest bison, and his zoo had had enormous success breeding endangered animals. As a nature lover and writer myself, I was both fascinated and horrified by the Nazi plan to control the genetic destiny of the planet. Why did this matter so much to the Nazis? Born in turn-of-the-century mystical cults in which they believed that their ancestors had come from Atlantis, Nazism hungered for its own private mythology, its own botany and biology, in which plants and animals displayed an ancient lineage that was undiluted by Asiatic or Mideastern blood. And that meant starting clean, replacing thousands of Polish farmers and so-called Slavic or Jewish crops and livestock with stronger Aryan ones. Through controlled breeding, the Nazis meant to erase Poland's genes from the planet and then move on to other countries and do the same thing. They even had a botanical commando squad, and that's the literal German translation. They were commandos because their job was to raid the botanical gardens in countries all over the world and steal the best specimens and bring them back to Germany for these breeding experiments. They hope to alter the world's ecosystems, not only dominate nations and politics, but the whole planet's DNA, changing the genetic spirals of evolution, a goal that, of course, legitimized genocide. But paradoxically, the Nazis also revered nature. They were ardent animal lovers and environmentalists who passed far-reaching animal rights policies as they rose to power. By our standards today, the Nazis led the world in being green. Under the Third Reich, animals became noble, mythic, almost angelic creatures, including humans, of course, but not Slavs, Jews, Catholics, Gypsies, homosexuals, and some others. Although Mengele's subjects in the concentration camps, including children, could be operated on without any painkillers whatsoever, a remarkable example of Nazi zoophilia is that a leading biologist was once punished for not giving worms enough anesthesia during an experiment. There's been so much written about the Nazis, but for me, looking at it from a natural history perspective, goes to the heart of what the Nazi lunacy was all about. Through their passion for genetics and the natural world, we can see the horror of what they were doing, but also a kind of what might have been an innocent obsession with nature and animals and the environment, rather wholesome, all things considered, coexisting with a maniacal, sadistic, murderous racism. The Szczepinskis, fortunately, found a way, an ingenious way, to capitalize on that paradox. Although Jan risked his life repeatedly and fought in the uprising and was wounded in the neck, he often said that the real hero of this saga was his wife, Antonina, who somehow combined cleverness and composure with fierce resolve. Her confidence could disarm even the most hostile, he said of her, adding that her strength stemmed from her unique love of animals. It wasn't just that she identified with them, but from time to time, he said, she actually seemed to shed her own human traits and become a panther or a lioness. And then, able to adopt their fighting instinct, she arose as a fearless defender of her kind. In her children's books, she actually writes from the perspective of animals, usually mother animals, and from right inside their sensibility. At one point, Hitler ordered Himmler to send in his harshest troops, to kill every Pole and pulverize the whole city block by block, bomb, torch, and bulldoze it beyond repair, to do this as a warning to the rest of occupied Europe. Antonina wrote in her diary that two SS men arrived. Suddenly, they opened the door, guns drawn, and yelled, "Everyone outside." Terrified, she and the others left the house and waited in the garden, not knowing what to expect, but fearing the worst. "Hands high," they yelled. Holding her baby, a newborn named Teresa, in her arms, she could only raise one hand, and her brain had trouble, as she put it, registering their vulgar, brutal sentences as they bellowed, "You'll pay for the deaths of our heroic German soldiers being slaughtered by your husbands and your sons. Your children," and they pointed to Riesch and Teresa, "suck in hatred for the German people along with their mother's milk. Up until now, we let you behave like this, but enough is enough. From now on, 1,000 Poles will be killed for every dead German." Surely this is the end, she thought. Hugging her baby tight, her mind darting to think up a plan, she felt her heart caged in her ribs and her legs became too heavy to move. It wasn't the first time that she literally froze in fear. On this occasion, although she couldn't move, she knew that she had to say something, anything, and stay calm. Talk to them the way that she used to soothe angry or ornery animals and gain their trust. Her mouth filled with German words that she didn't think she knew, and she began talking about the grandeur of German culture and about the ancient German tribes. As she hugged Teresa tighter, words streamed from her mouth, and in another chamber of mind, she concentrated hard and repeated over and over the silent command, "Calm down, put your guns down. Calm down, put your guns down. Calm down." The Germans continued yelling, which she didn't really hear, and they never lowered their guns. But in a spill of cobbled thoughts, she kept talking to them while issuing silent commands. Suddenly, a soldier looked at a 15-year-old helper and barked at him to go behind the shed in the garden. The boy started walking, followed by an SS man who reached into his pocket and pulled out a revolver as they disappeared from view, a single gunshot. The other German told Riesch, "You're next." Antonina saw her son's face shriek with fear, the blood drain out of it and his lips turn a light purple. She couldn't move and risk their killing her and Teresa too. Riesch raised his hands and started to walk slowly, robotically, as if life had already left his little body, she remembered later. Watching until he disappeared from view, she continued following him in her mind's eye. "Now he'll be close to the hollyhocks," she thought. "Now he'll be near the study window." A second shot. "It felt like a bayonet plunged into my heart," she wrote, "and we heard the third shot. I couldn't see anything. My vision became blank, then dark. I felt so weak. I was close to fainting." "You sit down on the bench," one German told her. "It's difficult to stand up with a child in your arms." A moment later, the same man called, "Hey, boys, bring me that chicken. Get him from behind the bushes." Both boys, very much alive, ran out from the shrubs, shaking with fear. Riesch was holding his dead pet chicken by its wing, and Antonina stared fixated at big drops of blood dripping from the chicken's bullet wounds. "We've played such a funny joke," a soldier said. Antonina saw their marble faces loosen into laughter as they left the garden, carrying the dead chicken, and she watched Riche slink low while trying hard not to cry until it was no use and tears flooded him. What could a mother do to comfort a child after that? Later, when she calmed down, she tried to diagnose the behavior of the SS soldiers. Did they ever consider shooting them? Or was it always a sick game of fear and power? Certainly, they hadn't known about the chicken, so they must have been improvising as they went along. She couldn't fathom their sudden tender-heartedness in urging her to sit down. Were they really worried that she might collapse holding her newborn? If so, she thought, maybe their monstrous hearts contain some human feeling. And if that's so, then pure evil doesn't really exist. She'd been so sure that the gunshots had killed the boys, that Riche lay crumpled on the ground with a bullet in his head. A mother's nervous system derails at such a time, and even though they'd all survived, she found herself sinking into a savage depression. Later, she berated herself for it in her diary. "My weakness shamed me," she wrote, "at precisely the time that I needed to be a leader of my little group." But she did lead her increasingly large group, and with great humanity. Although I'm nowhere near as brave, by a long shot, all along I felt very close to Antonina, who differed from me in many telling ways. She was Catholic, a Pole, born in Russia, orphaned as a child. Her parents were shot in the early days of the Russian Revolution. She was tall and blonde, a gifted pianist who grew up in the early 1900s, just to name a few things. But in some important other ways, her mindful senses, how intimately woven into nature she felt, her vertiginous empathy, both for people and for the other animals that we call animals, were surprisingly kindred spirits. I spent about 5 years of my life as a volunteer telephone crisis counselor, one of the suicide prevention and crisis hotlines, which I wrote about in a slender thread. Empathy and neighbors helping neighbors is very close to my heart. And like Antonina, I believe that people could, should, and often do feature the best of their nature while rising above the worst. Also, I understand her delight in folding up her idiosyncratic self and testing the world from the perspective of other animals. She'd love to do that. She did it with frisky relish throughout her children's books and memoirs and her life. The ability to shake off herself as if it were a sweater on a warm day and imaginatively enter the form of an animal, I think that was an avenue of escape for her, especially in difficult times, but also a form of play for her in happier times, as it has been for me too. But maybe the most remarkable thing about Antonina was her determination to include play, wonder, curiosity, marvel, and a wide stripe of innocence in a household where everyone knew and feared the ambient dangers, horrors, and uncertainties. That takes a special stripe of bravery that's rarely celebrated in wartime, when we associate heroes with stoicism, martyrdom, hatred, combat, violence, rarely with kindness. And yet human beings also perform legendary acts of mercy and heroism out of compassion. Staying emotionally limber enough to love, play, nurture, marvel, despite all the ligatures of war, that takes a rare kind of courage. As you'll discover in Zookeeper, this also happened in the Warsaw Ghetto, where Rabbi Shapira, the Hasidic rabbi, urged his flock to transcend by meditating on the beauty of nature and the workings of the mind as a way to somehow stay sane. It happened in the ghetto orphanage, where Janusz Korczak taught his children to stage transcendent theater and practice Zen-like chores. And at the zoo, Antonina not only hit a stream of escaping Jews and members of the underground, but she ran a household filled with music, art, animals, good humor, many innocent distractions. Surely that courage appears somewhere every day on our perpetually war-torn planet. Why we empathize and act heroically isn't hard to unravel scientifically, but why we don't talk about it much, why we prefer to highlight the worst in human nature instead, is altogether more puzzling. What fascinates me is how often and with what wholeheartedness ordinary people will perform acts of compassion, courage, and sacrifice for absolute strangers. When big game hunter Lutz Heck visited the Warsaw Zoo, I'm sure that he had absolutely no idea what risk takers the Jabinskis really were, nor that their quest would span years and dwarf all of his exploits and daring. At a time when handing a thirsty refugee a cup of water was punishable by death, it makes the heroism of rescuers like the Jabinskis all the more startling. And one can't help but wonder, would I have had their courage? Would I have found their compassion? Antonina's story has slipped between the seams of history, as radically compassionate acts sometimes do. I feel that part of my calling as a writer is to celebrate her great generosity, courage, and humanity. There are many forms of obsession. Some are diabolical, some fortuitous. Out of terrible motives, the Nazis tried to preserve extinct animals and a wilderness where rare flora and fauna now thrive. It's called Białowieża. It's one of the World Heritage Sites, and there are more rare animals and plants per square inch than one can imagine there. It would have been invaded and destroyed, but for the fact that the Nazis wanted to keep it going as a royal game preserve for Hitler. Wonderful story of good coming out of evil. And thanks to the Jabinskis, scores of Warsaw Jews also survived to continue their own ancient lineage in other lands. I feel that Antonina and Jan's story needs to be told today because these are also days of genocide. It's not something that just happens in history. And because this is a tale of heroic compassion, something that so-called ordinary people do rise to in every era, in every country, though we hear precious little about those dramas. For their sake, it's time that the Jabinskis became role models too. Thank you. And now I think we do have time for some questions. Let's see if I can read them. All right. I loved your book, Deep Play. Can you tell us about an experience you've had recently of ecstatic play? Biking. I love to bike. And I have a wonderful, well, they now call them an upright bike or a boomer bike, you know, with a wicker basket and a cute little ice cream bell and everything. And I like to go biking. And there was a red-tailed hawk flying over. And the sun was shining through its tail feathers. It looked like stained glass. And in that moment, I didn't want the universe to be anything other than it was. Life was absolutely perfect. And I felt about 11 years old. It was a moment of pure rapture. But I do have those ecstatic moments very often. Partly, I was just born like this. And partly, I make room for it in my life. My husband and I swim most days in the summer. And this past summer, every single day in the swimming pool, we would stop. And even though he knew, I'm sure, that I was going to say this to him, nonetheless, he would play dumb. And I would say, "Want to know a secret? We live on a planet. We live on a planet in space. And there are trees on this planet, and there are human beings. Isn't this strange and wonderful and bizarre?" And we would just look up at the sky and look up at the clouds and think about the far reaches of space. That kind of ecstasy, that kind of playfulness, is something that I've really grown to love and couldn't live without. So recently, all the time. What's it like sharing your life with a writer, Paul West? We've been together for 38 years now. Yes, I was only 5 when we got married. You know, there are some states in which that's allowed and stuff. And once we gave a reading together, and we were introduced as two people who have absolutely nothing in common. And that's true, nothing in common but love. And the fact that we're both playful little tykes, and love language, and so on. My study is all windows, floor-to-ceiling windows, and when it was being painted, I asked the painters in Ithaca, the paint company was called Van Gogh Painters. Their slogan was, "Worth the Monet." It's a very Ithaca thing. Ithaca, I swear, consists entirely of therapists and artists. And just a few, like, massage people, you know, kind of thrown in there. Anyway, I told them that I wanted it yellow. They said, "What shade of yellow?" I said, "I'd like it the yellow of spring light in the forest." They said, "Sure, sure." His study has no windows at all. He says he doesn't need nature. He's a fiction writer. He can create nature. In some ways, we're very different. In some ways, very similar. Let's see. What gave you the idea to write a natural history of the senses? You know, I was telling my then agent for the longest time that I wanted to write a natural history of the senses. And he was saying, "Oh, no, nobody's going to be interested in that. Nobody's going to be interested in that." And I said, yeah, but I, you know, this is just something that's consumed me my whole life, and I really want to write about it. So I went home, and I spent a weekend writing a 30-page proposal, and I sent it to him. And he called me up, and he said, "Oh, everybody will be interested in that." If I just couldn't explain it right. But, you know, when I began to make it clear that really this is something that touches everybody's life, this is life, this is the texture of our lives, then it made a lot more sense to him. It was not so much that I had the idea to write it. It's that I had been living it, thinking it, feeling it, experiencing it my whole life. And I wanted the excuse just to explore the senses more, celebrate them more, maybe in some way give people a sense of permission to rejoice in the sensory extravaganza of being alive. Because we do live in a somewhat puritanical culture that discourages us from such things. How do you engage with nature in your daily life? Well, first of all, I should explain that I don't draw a line between me and nature, or between humans and nature, or like between plants, you know, cornflowers here, amino acids over there, science, humans, nature. For me, it's all part of a spectrum, just one spectrum, all of which is nature. So I consider cities, nature, you know, termites build mounds, humans build cities. Some animals have carapaces. We have cars that we travel around in. But all of it really is nature in the widest sense. And so I feel intimately a part of nature. But having said that, in the summer, I like to spend maybe half an hour in the morning out in the rose garden. I raise roses organically. I have about 120 rose bushes, but I don't count them every day. I'm told that would be obsessive. I go out, and they are kind of my mantra. You know, I just tell them how beautiful they are. "You're so beautiful," I tell them. And I enjoy their scent. I bring some in, and I arrange them, not letting anything so rude as thought intrude, really. And so I'm just lost in that period before I start work. I also have a bay window that I love to climb into. It's about halfway up a magnolia tree. So it's right in the middle of the petals, the birds, things like that. And there are many plants around, kind of unruly, wanton beds. And every now and again, there will be something like a hummingbird, or one day there was a bee. It was a little chilly. And if it's cooler than about 55 degrees, bees can't use their flight muscles. So if they don't make it back to the hive, they have to just stop somewhere. And this one stopped on a Fothergilla leaf, and it had those little polleny saddlebags that bees get when they've been collecting pollen. And I was just enthralled watching this. And I thought I'd spend some time with it. And after a while, it did start to wake up. And it did one of those little hokey pokey moves, you know, with the legs, and just kind of got itself going. I love that. I just love that. So I do that, or I watch the hawks, or I play with the flowers. And you can probably even hear, as I'm saying this to you, that I'm really only about 11. The minute we start talking about things like this, it's play. It's playing outdoors, playing in nature. When I was little, I begged to go outside. "Let me go outside, Mom, and play." I don't have to beg to do that now, but I still go outside and play. How is your process different writing poetry versus writing prose? Well, some people may have noticed that I sometimes insinuate what I think of as unrequited poems into my prose. The process is a little different. There are times when I can't decide whether certain images are going to go into a poem or into a paragraph. And that becomes a problem. But most often, the poetry doesn't require the kind of elbow room and research that the prose does. And when I say requires the kind of research that the prose does, well, for example, the other day I noticed, when I was in Florida, I noticed something almost visible that was just skittering across the table. It was almost visible, just enough to get your attention, but you couldn't see it. And then it happened again. And then I got really interested and put my glasses on and started looking. And there was something called ghost ants. People know about ghost ants? Can you make listening noises, ghost ant noises or something? Yeah, okay, good. Some of you know about ghost ants. Okay. Well, these are they have translucent bodies. They're very strange little things. And so I started writing about it, like a kind of prose poem about it, but I wanted to know more. And so I started researching it. Also, I very rarely do that with poems, but in the case of prose, of course I do. In the case of The Zookeeper's Wife, this was a new genre for me. It's narrative nonfiction. It's completely true. Every time somebody speaks, I'm quoting directly from their memoirs, interviews, testimonies, something like that. So I don't create any of the scenes. But I wanted to be able to convey the atmosphere of really being there, being in Antonina's life. And so for that, I had to study the natural history of Poland during 1939 and 40 and so on. And because she lived in the middle of a very active zoo, I needed to find out what animals were at the zoo and what the behaviors of the animals were and what the calls of the different animals were and which animals called first in the morning at dawn and so on, things like that. A lot of fun for me, but much more of a puzzle. Writing poetry in some ways is more fulfilling, even though I write much more prose. And I think that's because the distance between the inspiration and having something complete that you can hold all in one place, in one page like that, is very brief. It may only be a week, let's say. And I have a stronger emotional, more immediate emotional connection to a poem. I just can't choose. My muse is very miscellaneous. I don't like to have to choose too much. What is your greatest challenge in researching your works of nonfiction? Well, I guess they really all are challenging. But writing is my form of inquiry. It's also my form of celebration and prayer, but it's really much, very much a form of satisfying my curiosity about the world. So the research isn't a burden, which is not to say that I don't moan and complain about it sometimes at home. When I do that, my husband says, "What else would you be doing with your life?" You know, something like that. But I enjoy it. I love learning. I've become a much better student since I got out of college than I ever was in college. And doing the so-called research teaches me about life on Earth, and I really love that. Has the poetic form become too small for you? No. I love the, you know, trying to reduce something to the rigorous pungency of an epigram. That is so much fun. I think it must be what, like, watchmakers feel when they're just toying for hours with little cogs and little wheels. You have to love doing that kind of thing. I would be bored doing other things that people are supreme at, but I happen to love trying to find the right words, especially the right verbs, for how things are. For life's processes. There is a stage in every prose book when I really just go through it and lean on the verbs. And I'm always just tinkering, trying to find the right words. Do you have a favorite love poem? I love Neruda's poems, love poems. Those are absolutely exquisite. If you haven't read them, I encourage you to. There's a collection called 20 Poems of Love and One of Despair. In your dissertation defense, what did Carl Sagan ask you? I can say this now that A.R. Ammons is no longer with us. My doctoral committee included a poet, A.R. Ammons, and a scientist, Carl Sagan, wonderful prose writer, James McConkie, who was specialty was comp lit. And having these people on my committee made it possible for me to get away with so much mischief in college. You know, I could take physics for poets, and I could write an interdisciplinary PhD and do things like that. But there was just a tiny bit of jealousy going on. And Archie kept scheduling the dissertation defense for days until he found one that Carl couldn't make it on. So he was not there, but Carl was a wonderful advisor, and after that, friend. He was very much open to the notion of exploration wherever it happened, and it was just great about sharing his knowledge with me and also his resources. In 1972 and 73 and so on, the best NASA photographs of the planets, of the outplanets especially, were just little balls of light with arrows pointing at them. That was it. It was possible to learn everything that humans knew about the planets. Not possible now, but it was then. And Carl also made it possible to go to many of the NASA flybys of the planets and to have a lot of fun. This is very sweet. Reading your, I guess I'll take this as the last one. Reading your works is like eating rich dessert. Do these words pop right out, or do you rewrite often? Often, very, very often. Every time, well, each day I try to read the whole manuscript up to where I've left off so that I know where I am. And every time that I do that, I'm tinkering with little things, revising. Maybe it's a kind of OCD quality in me, I don't know, or in all writers. But there is something very precious and calming about hovering over each word and trying to see if you can picture it a little more clearly, you know, if you can just nail down that scent a little more closely. Then for me, I have recorded it in a way that I will be able to remember it and conjure it up in my own senses later on. So it means the world to me to do that, just for personal reasons. But also, it would really be great if I could write books that allow readers to see through the lens of my sensibility and travel with me. And so to do that, I need that to create that sensory texture. And what fun it is. It's like playing in an ice cream shop to be just tinkering with those little sights and smells and tastes and sounds and everything in the words that we've given them on a daily basis. So the answer is not just often, but I guess compulsively and with limitless relish. Yeah. I suppose I better stop there, but I thank you all very much.
That was Diane Ackerman speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2007. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. And to help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.